This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for June 20th, 2019. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we hear from the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project in Portland on support work for the over 200 African asylum seekers recently arrived in Maine and the impacts of federal and state policy. And we get an update on the status of Central Maine Power's proposed 145-mile so-called New England Clean Energy Connect transmission line, which would bring power from Canada to Massachusetts in a swath through Maine. Governor Mills just vetoed two bills which would have allowed for local input by impacted communities. We spoke earlier this afternoon with Julia Brown, an attorney with the Portland-based Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, on the over 200 asylum seekers from predominantly the war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola. She spoke with us about what asylum seekers are up against, the efforts Mainers are engaging in to support them, and how the state and federal government has increased their precarious positions. Julia Brown with the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, we thank you for joining us today to give us some updates on the recent influx of asylum seekers in Portland, what the picture on the ground is, what Mainers can do who wish to help in the welcoming process, and some of the legal issues and challenges that the asylum seekers are facing, both at the state level but also in the national climate we're seeing with immigrant and refugee policy. So can you start, there's been a lot of great news coverage, but can you start by orienting listeners again of who has come? We understand the numbers have already risen, and what that story is on the ground with this influx of people fleeing and applying for asylum here in Maine.
Sure. So I first want to start by saying that we have seen folks fleeing violence from Central Africa coming to Portland over the last year or so. So the actual individuals who are coming, the nature of them is not any different. There have just been more in the last couple of weeks. So in the last couple of weeks, Portland has welcomed about maybe 60 families or so, give or take. The number fluctuates, of families who come from Angola and Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, as I might refer to it later. Mm-hmm. And those DRC is experiencing extreme violence right now, and the same in Angola. And so we're seeing people coming and seeking safety in the United States. And the interesting part about their journey is that because the current administration has tightened a lot of immigration policy. The Trump administration. It is becoming a lot more difficult for families to get visas to come to the United States. And so there are several ways in which someone can seek asylum here. The first way is by coming to the United States on, let's say, a visitor visa or a student visa and asking for asylum once they arrive. That is much more difficult for people who can't get into the country to do so. So another way to request asylum is to come to a border of the country and ask for asylum there. And so that's what we are seeing right now. We're seeing families flying to countries in South America where they can get a visa, and then traveling by land in a very harrowing and traumatic months-long journey to get to the southern border of the United States to seek safety for their families.
And joining multiple people from Latin America who are trying to apply for asylum in that the same way.
Exactly. So whenever you hear about things happening at the southern border, we're often talking about families seeking asylum, and a lot of them are from Central America, but the families that we're seeing in Portland are from Central Africa.
Again, so once people have been waiting for months at the border to be allowed to cross, they are now in the process of trying to be granted asylum, and that's also a long wait, but they are allowed then in that interim to locate, and many people have come to Maine where there is a strong African community, as well as Portland is a known refugee relocation center, is that right?
Certainly, it seems that people who are arriving have heard of Portland, and we're not sure if that's because of Portland's general welcoming nature or if it's because of the already significant numbers of people from Central Africa who have settled here. And so people tend to go where they have community. And so it makes sense that they'd be coming here.
So talk a little bit more about what's happening right now. There's now over 200 people who have come to Portland. They're being housed in the expo. There's talk about what the on the ground work is being done right now to try to support people.
Sure. So it's been very heartwarming to see both people from Portland and the city of Portland, but also everyone in Maine coming together, giving resources and trying to help the newly arrived families as much as possible. And organizations like the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition, or MIRC, have done an incredible job of gathering food and resources and interpreters, because language access is a huge issue that we're facing, and getting everyone together, everyone in the community galvanized to help feed and house these families.
Can I just interrupt? The types of interpreters they're looking for are for French and what else?
Portuguese and Lingala. Lingala is a language that is spoken in DRC, and we're finding that some folks only speak Lingala. So while some people might speak both French and Lingala or Portuguese and Lingala, some only speak Lingala, so it's vital that we have Lingala interpreters for them.
So we know that yesterday the Maine legislature passed a bill, although I don't know what you'll have to give us the update on where the bill is right now, but to restore LePage cutbacks that had taken away access to assistance programs to documented immigrants and asylum applicants, including MaineCare, food stamps, cash assistance. Can you talk with us about the efforts to restore this assistance to those who are coming and those who are here?
I unfortunately have bad news about that bill. So that bill, LD 1317, like you said, would have restored access to life-sustaining programs for people who are seeking asylum and certain other immigrants who used to be eligible for these programs, but it was cut by Governor LePage. The bill did pass the House, but unfortunately it was not voted on in the Senate, and so we're considering it dead. It's possible that it could be revived, but I don't know that it will be. So right now the governor has the power to at least restore general assistance for those folks who used to receive it. And so that would be the next step.
So right now there is nothing that the state can offer, or what kind of assistance can be offered at the town level, or is this left up to those who are coming to try to figure out how to survive?
So we've seen the community definitely step up, and Portland step up, and other cities around the state are stepping up. And we have heard that a number of surrounding towns around Portland have offered assistance. But the Mills administration does have the authority and the money to help people seeking asylum in Maine. So they could act immediately to provide general assistance to those families who have fled violence, and we encourage them to do so.
Have you seen any signals to your organization from the Mills administration that this is something that's being seriously considered?
So while we haven't received signals one way or the other about this particular issue, Governor Mills did come to Portland and meet with officials and is very aware of how much state government could help. So we're very hopeful that she will act to restore general assistance for those folks.
You are listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Julia Brown, an attorney with the Portland-based Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, on the over 200 asylum seekers who arrived last week in Portland, primarily from the war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola. So tell us a little bit more about what an asylum seeker now can expect now that they're here, as far as a process of being granted asylum status and what their day-to-day reality and needs are at this point.
So the first, of course, high-level needs of the families who have arrived are food and shelter. But beyond that, one of their most immediate needs is legal help. And that is because when someone comes at the border seeking asylum, they're in a posture known as defensive asylum, which means that they will be presenting their asylum case in immigration court. And a number of the families that we've seen arrived in a way that they are not allowed to work until they have applied for asylum, and then it would be 6 months after that that they would be allowed to work. So there's a long wait time. But beyond that, there are a lot of complications that come with coming across the border and requesting asylum that way. First, many of the folks who crossed and have sought asylum have court dates in courts, immigration court, that is far away from Boston. And that's for a number of reasons, but it is very difficult to get your court changed to the court near where you live, which for us is Boston, because there are several steps that you need to take. There are a lot of little details that can cause a lot of issues for asylum seekers who don't have a lawyer's advice.
If Mainers want to help and participate in any support services, what would you recommend to folks?
So the biggest need right now is for donations. There are a number of places to donate your money, and that can include the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition, or MIRC, has a fund to help with a lot of the needs that asylum seekers have. And I believe there are other places to donate that you can find through their Facebook page. And ILAP does not have any federal funding. We only have donations and grants to operate off of, and we are Maine's only comprehensive statewide nonprofit legal aid provider. So ILAP always needs funds. And then there are also opportunities for volunteering that you can find on the City of Portland's website. And that information will also have what kind of donations they need. So things like diapers and clothing. They may not be accepting them at the moment because they had such a great outpouring of support, but I'm sure that those needs will happen again.
And in talking about the legal support that you were just describing, is the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project trying to step in to represent a number of these asylum seekers, or where is that need gap right now?
So the first line of legal help will be information, so making sure that folks have accurate information about the asylum process, and then assistance helping them change their address. So a lot of people who arrived in Portland have, you know, different cities across the United States on their paperwork, and we want to make sure that those addresses are changed to Portland. And the reason that it's vital that they have the correct address is because any notices about court hearings will come to that address on file, and that address has to be correct. Because if you miss a court hearing, then the government can order you deported. So our priority is getting people the proper procedure to change their address so that they don't miss any court hearings.
And what about housing and the lack of housing right now?
The lack of housing is definitely an issue. From the latest that I've heard, Portland has been working very hard to get folks housed. As you've said, they are currently at the Portland Expo Center, which is hopefully a very temporary solution. And I know that the towns and cities are working to figure out a solution.
And finally, any comments that you might have, Julia Brown, with Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project on the national climate concerning immigration and asylum policy? We are hearing Trump making noises right now that there's going to be major crackdowns on immigrants. Comments on the national climate and how that's impacting immigrants and asylum seekers here in Maine.
Sure. So asylum is a legal and a human right. People absolutely have the right to seek safety when they are fleeing persecution and violence. So that's the first thing. The current administration is attempting to make asylum extremely difficult to get, and they're doing that in a number of ways, by reducing the ability to get a visa to this country, by blocking people from approaching U.S. border posts, which is what we're hearing is happening at the border, turning them away when they come to a port of entry, and then also all of the slowdowns in processing and bottlenecking is creating really long waits in Mexico. And when we know that when people are sleeping outside near the ports of entry at the border, that they are vulnerable to violence and kidnapping and trauma that they've already are fleeing. And so the administration is doing its best to make it extremely difficult to seek asylum. So that's very worrisome. The administration also, as we've seen from the president's tweets this week, is constantly attempting to create fear and anxiety among the immigrant population. And that is something that is very easy for him to do because he can just say that he's going to deport a million people without giving any facts to back that up. And so our advice on that is that, as far as we can tell, that tweet was referring to people who have something that's called an order of removal already. So that's someone who's already been ordered deported by the government. And we will have information for those individuals on our Facebook page and our website. But people who are in removal proceedings with notices to appear, like many of the families at the Expo Center, are not in danger of immediate deportation. And they will be given their day in court. And so it is imperative that they attend their immigration court hearings. And that's the information that we're going to be trying to get out. In this climate of fear, the best defense is information and advocacy. And so that's what we always are trying to do.
Well, Julia Brown with the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, thanks for joining us with that update today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for talking with me.
We have with us today Matt Wagner with NECEC, New England Clean Energy Connect, the 145-mile Central Maine Power high-voltage and highly controversial transmission line corridor, which would bring electric power from Hydro-Quebec through Maine to Massachusetts markets. There has been a concerted and growing opposition to this mega project from a wide swath of communities, groups, and individuals concerned with environmental impacts on wetlands, waterways, and habitat, and concerned with democratic and local control. A number of bills that would have potentially impacted the project were presented in the legislature at the end of the session. One bill would have required a study to examine the claims that the NECEC would benefit efforts to assuage climate change, and two others which would have given municipalities and local governments power to approve transmission line projects and the taking of lands through eminent domain. These two bills, LD 1382 and 1363, both passed the full legislature, but were vetoed by Governor Mills, who has thrown her full support behind the CMP, New England Clean Energy Connect. Again, we have with us today Matt Wagner to update us on the end of the legislature session and the status of the CMP project. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thank you, Meredith.
So talk with us about these legislative attempts to curtail or reform Central Power and Hydro-Quebec's transmission line project and where things stand now. I know that's an all-encompassing question, but maybe we can start with the bills.
Right. There's a lot to all of those. So LD 640, which would have required a third-party greenhouse gas analysis of Central Maine Power Company Avangrid's claims that there's going to be a net carbon benefit lost, wasn't supported, which is incredibly disappointing because we need to show that this is a coconut shell game with carbon emissions, Massachusetts essentially outsourcing their pollution to Canada, where there's less environmental regulation.
And in fact, the Massachusetts Attorney General even made a statement stating their opinion that climate change would not be impacted. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, CMP has changed their language to from claiming the environmental benefits to claiming regional environmental benefits. So they're totally aware that their claims aren't, you know, substantiatable. They just don't want their day in court. CMP had 31 lobbyists in Augusta lobbying for the defeat of LD 640 and local control bills.
In the case of all three bills, actually, they passed, but the bill that would have required a climate change study didn't pass with enough votes to make it go into effect quickly enough to impact the project. And you can correct me on that.
Right. And that was an emergency bill, so it had to pass the 2/3 support.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. It was short.
And then in the case of the two bills, which you can tell us a little bit more about, that would have given more power to municipalities and local governments to approve transmission lines cutting through their communities, they both did pass the full legislature, and it was the governor who vetoed these bills. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because indeed, in your work, you've
right.
seen there's been quite diverse coalition, not necessarily along partisan lines, that are opposing this bill, and a lot of concern about local control. So passing a legislature, but vetoed by Mills. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an extremely diverse group of people that opposes CMP. Everybody, all walks of life. I mean, it's one of the most impressive movements and organizations that I've ever seen in Maine. I mean, people agree on something. I mean, the town of Wilton voted unanimously, 200 people voted unanimously to oppose the construction of this through their town. That doesn't come regularly to Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So we have extremely broad bipartisan support in the House and the Senate as well. Governor Mills ran on, I believe her statement was having serious concerns about this project, and as soon as she was elected, she threw, you know, her full-hearted support behind it and announced that she would veto every bill that came before her that would slow down this project, and that's exactly what she did. And unfortunately, we were close, but did not have the votes to override her veto.
And so talk a little bit more then about local control, because as you just said, Wilton and other communities have rejected it, but maybe those rejections don't have the adequate teeth under state law. Can you talk about now where things stand, or if there's hope to still push those efforts as far as local input and say on a transmission line that would come through their communities?
Well, I mean, there will be legal battles. The town of Caratunk has a moratorium on the development of this sort of infrastructure. I mean, their town says no. They passed a rule in town that says you can't build this here. That means that Central Maine Power Company is going to have to use eminent domain to take that right from that community. That's what's going to happen, and that will be a legal fight that won't go unchallenged. Many communities have voted to oppose this. New Sharon recently just voted, I don't have the exact vote, but it was along the lines of 80-2 to oppose this. They've just sent a letter of opposition to the state. I mean, almost every significantly impacted community has voted, not just unanimously, but, you know, virtually unanimously up and down the line. I mean, small towns voting, you know, 42-12, you know, or I think Dennistown was like 12-9. You know, they voted unanimously. But that's...
So
that's what it's looking like. What remains in the fight, they still don't have most of the permits that they need. That's the Land Use Planning Commission, the DEP, and the Army Corps of Engineers all still need mm-hmm. to issue permits. And there's serious concerns there. Next Thursday, the DEP and LUPC are planning on visiting the area up around the forks. And there's plans for those communities to line both sides of 201 with their cars to show those commissioners and DEP personnel that these communities mean business, and we're not going to just let this come through our towns and our communities and ruin our small businesses and our recreational tourism. And I mean, we're not going to be sold out for Massachusetts. We're not going to just take it.
So again, you said the permits they're looking for now are in front of the DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, the land use. What's the acronym for LUPC now? It's changed the land use.
Yeah, so the acronym, it used to be called LURC.
Yes.
And now it's called the Land Use Planning Commission.
Right.
So it's the LUPC.
Can you just talk a little bit more about what they're supposed to be looking at in their permitting?
they all look at impacts to wildlife, water, scenic values. There are a number of issues that they need to look into, but the biggest ones are, you know, scenic values and water, endangered species. They never look at impacts to local communities or cultural values or long-term environmental impact, such as climate change. Those aren't issues that they are examining, and those are the issues we feel like they should have been examining, whether there was actually a climate benefit, net climate benefit. Because one of the threats of this project is that it actually derails Maine's own ability to develop renewable energy projects.
Talk about that a little more.
Solar projects or wind projects. This project drives down the capacity to develop those. We lose economic benefit there, too.
Talk about that a little bit more. We had someone on the program before talking about how is it that this passing of this electricity through Maine holds off the development of alternative energy. Can you please expound on that?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of the big renewable energy projects in Maine is already a net energy exporter. We already make more energy than we consume by about 8%. So we're already sending electricity out of state. So when you see more generation added to Maine, whether it's solar or wind or biomass or even natural gas, that electricity goes into the ISO New England grid, which powers, you know, all the other states that are connected to us in that grid. So this is going to have a downward pressure on those states' appetite to develop more renewable energy projects, which could be placed in Maine through their own state's RFPs. That's how the New England Clean Energy Connect project was selected for development, was through a Massachusetts RFP. And as you already mentioned, now the Massachusetts Attorney General has come out and said this might not satisfy the RFP. This may not be, you know, a carbon-reducing proposal.
And Matt, can you talk at all about the impacts in Hydro-Quebec's region in Canada? That's where the hydropower will be coming. What are the impacts we're seeing there?
Absolutely. They have another organization called North American Mega Dam Resistance, and they have great information on their site. This year is the last year that a wild free-flowing river is going to enter Happy Valley Goose Bay, which is one of the largest freshwater ecosystems on the Atlantic seaboard. It's where the building blocks of our own Gulf of Maine ecosystem come from. That's silica diatoms, which are the base of the food system. And these impoundments will create an area the size of New York State underwater to send electricity to Massachusetts. The environmental impact is beyond staggering. The methylmercury poisoning of indigenous peoples is gaining interest from the United Nations. The other side of this coin, the environmental destruction in Canada, is beyond anything that we can fathom.
Matt, we're going to have you back on the program and specifically focus on this. Anything that you would like to say in conclusion, would love to have you back on, but where things stand right now and where people can go for more information.
Yeah, I would love to say thank you to you for hosting this program. It's a huge help to have a voice on the coast. Western Maine needs people on the coast to pay attention to this issue. It's the largest development in Maine since the Maine State Turnpike was built. The impact on this is not something that will ever be erased from our landscape. And I hope folks can, if they're on Facebook, join us at Say No to NECEC. We also have a website. Write letters to the editor. Call your representatives. Show up in Augusta. Show up in the Forks next Thursday.
Well, Matt Wagner with No NECEC, thanks for joining us. Again, there's a lot more information, including the impacts on streams, wetlands, fish habitat that we didn't get a chance to get to. But we'll have you back on or someone to talk about this project. As you said, it's a mega project affecting all Mainers and obviously specifically impacting a number of communities in opposition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Radioactive on WERU Community Radio. We'd like to thank Alan Sprague for production assistance today. You can listen to archives of this and other locally produced public affairs programming at weru.org.